Thank you, Robin, very much. I also want to thank Perry Hoffman and Dixie Penny for inviting me. It's a very important and interesting meeting. I also want to acknowledge the support of the Borderline Research Foundation for the work that I'm about to present. That's collaborative with Anthony Beatman. But before I start, I also want to acknowledge my indebtedness to Otto Kernberg, who has been was an inspiration for me when I started in this field, and remained an inspiration. I think that's a remarkable thing. It's very easy for someone to inspire you to start something, but for them to inspire you to continue doing it is really quite a different matter altogether. And I just hope for myself, very selfishly, that when I'm at his stage of professional development, I will be able to embrace new ideas with the flexibility and enthusiasm and intellectual energy that he's able to embrace hierarchical linear modeling at his stage, and talk of random regression models when his original training about regression was really of quite a different kind. Anthony Beatman and I have worked together in this project, but other people have been involved as well. Mary Targe and George Gage at University College London, Linda Mays at the Yale Child Study Center, and at the Menninger Bieler Department of Psychiatry, Efrain Blyberg, John Allen, and Helen Stein. So let me start by some general remark about the nature of board therapies. I think, firstly, many individuals, as we heard a number of times during these meetings, with BPD recover to a significant extent without extensive formal therapeutic intervention. And there is hope in that. Also, that many therapies are highly effective for borderline personality disorder. But isn't there a contradiction here? And I think the contradiction is the reason why we had believed that therapies were quite, perhaps not quite as effective as the natural course of the disorder would lead us to believe is a very worrying one, is that many therapies appear to do harm to individuals with borderline personality disorder, or at least to be able to impede a natural process of recovery. Now, this may be an unpopular position to take, but I do believe that individuals with this disorder are more vulnerable, for reasons that I hope I will be able to explain during the course of my talk, to well-intentioned, but what medical jargon terms, iatrogenic interventions that do harm. And the central principle that we adhere to is that a therapeutic treatment will be effective to the extent that it is able to enhance the patient's mentalizing capacities without generating too many iatrogenic effects. That is, that there is a common feature to therapies that work with borderline personality disorder. They all, one way or another, enhance the individual's capacity to use their mind to organize the mind's own content. And I will talk about this during the course of my talk. But I think what this central principle underscores is that it's all very well for people during this talk or after the talk to come and say to me, well, what you do, guys, in London is exactly the same as what we are doing wherever. I'm very pleased to hear that, and I warmly congratulate you or your colleagues on this. But I don't think that's quite as important as what else you do. So I think what is not done in a therapy may be as much to do with its success as what is done. And there, I think, we are far less. This is, to me, the major question for this field, to identify what the things are not to do with this group of patients. I know this is controversial, and maybe I'll just say sorry now. You know, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Related to this, I think it's very important, for example, with this group, just as an example of the not done thing, it's very important to be authentic with this group of patients. Not to say something that you don't mean. And if you frequently say something that you don't mean, you confuse these patients far more than other groups of patients. So, if this group was that sort of, I would say, well, actually, I did not mean what I said when I said that I was sorry. I'm not at all sorry. Okay, so the issues for this presentation, and I'll rush through it. I'm not going to use half the slides that I have in the folder. You can look at the slides if you're really, really very, very bored and have absolutely nothing that you have to do. So I'll talk about four things: the focus of the therapy, the technique of the therapy, the outcome of the therapy, and the mechanisms of treatment, which we have some speculative ideas about, related to both understanding the pathology and understanding the interventions. So, what is the focus of this treatment? The nature of mentalization, and Dr. Kernberg very graciously started talking about this, that there are psychological skills that allow us to make sense of the actions of others as well as one's own actions by referring to mental states. And we are the only species on God's earth that tries to make sense of the behavior of conspecifics, other members of the species, by assuming that that other individual has a mind and that beliefs, wishes, desires, hopes, fantasies might explain why they behave the way they do. This is a spontaneous process, it is intuitive, and it is totally non-conscious. And we do it absolutely all the time. It is deeply ingrained into our emotional lives, and it's central to understanding and regulating of all emotions. Emotions relate to one's goals and intentions and desires. We have beliefs about if a goal is met, whether we have achieved what we wanted to achieve. And mentalization, therefore, is, in a sense, by definition, inexact. We know what we think and feel, but we have to share our internal experiences with others in order to make that meaningful. Reflections on our own state is essential and healthy for a coherent sense of oneself. And that sense of coherence is really what I believe psychological health is all about. But to state it most generally, mentalization, thinking and feeling, thinking about thoughts and feelings, beliefs and desires, is something that we acquire developmentally. It happens around the age 4 or 5 that it emerges. It becomes increasingly complex with development and is only gradually achieved fully, and is unfortunately readily lost. Now, what's the bottom line in all this? So let me just give my conclusions whilst you're still attentive and think that what I'm saying is worth listening to. So what is it we are saying that's new here? Well, what I'm trying to argue is that there are certain groups of patients who have something like a decoupling or an active inhibition of a capacity to think and to think about mental states, to mentalize. For these individuals, we have to focus on enhancing their capacity to do so. Borderline personality disorder and other severe personality disorders may be in this group, including, for example, delinquent young men for the most part, chronic trauma patients, some somatic disorders, and some multiple complex developmental disorders. With these patients, the explicit content of what we talk to them about is just a vehicle for an implicit therapeutic process of helping them, assisting them to fully recover the capacity to perceive and regulate what's going on in their minds, their thoughts, their feelings, their wishes in relation to themselves and in relation to others. So what's the technique that we use to achieve this? Well, there is a book by Anthony Bateman and myself that actually does try and become a manual for a dynamic psychotherapy with borderline personality disorders. I'm not saying, Otto, that yours is not the only manual. I would say yours is the only really good manual. This is a very second-rate manual. When we wrote it, we thought it was a manual. But why do we need a new therapy for this group? I think, as Dr. Kernberg also outlined, we needed a new psychodynamic approach, because unmodified psychoanalytic approaches, I think, do not work very well, and maybe the reason for this is because they have iatrogenic components. So in summary, in our approach, we exclusively focus on the patient's current mental state. We avoid situations where the patient talks of mental states that they cannot link to subjectively felt reality. We de-emphasize deep unconscious concerns in favor of what's near conscious or conscious content, at least initially. We modify our aim. Our aim is not to give patients insight into the reasons they behave the way they behave. It is to recover the capacity to think about behavior in terms of mental states. So achieving representational coherence and integration is our aim. And in this, I think we share quite a bit with transference-focused psychotherapy. We also avoid describing complex mental states of conflict, of ambivalence, of unconscious processes, and we make much more what we call small interpretations, interpretations related to the patient's immediate social situation. We try to create a transitional area of relatedness where thoughts and emotions can be played with. Where you can try and say, well, maybe you thought this, maybe you thought that. And I'll try and illustrate that in a moment. We deal with the enactments, the actions that occur in the course of therapy in terms of the antecedent affects, in terms of the feelings that weren't coped with before the action took place, rather than trying to find what the meaning of that action might be. So the therapist's stance in doing this is continually to question his or her mind what the patient's internal state might be. What's happening now? Why is the patient saying this now? Why is the patient behaving like this? Why am I feeling the way that I do? What has happened recently in the therapy that may justify my current state? And this leads to questioning comments to promote that kind of exploration in the therapy situation. What do you make of what has just happened here? Why do you think you said that? I wonder how that's related to what happened in your group yesterday. Or perhaps you felt that I was judging you and that's why you reacted the way that you did. What did you make of this other patient's suicidal feelings that they talked about in the group? Why do you think he behaved towards you as you did? All the time relentlessly focusing on mental states, the states of mind, the thoughts, feelings, wishes, beliefs and desires that underline behavior. So in one aspect, of this, just one actually as an example, is how we always try to highlight how the same piece of behavior, the same environmental event, can be viewed in a number of different ways. So you might say, I saw it as criticism, as a way that you use what you use to control yourself rather than to attack me. So you criticized me, but I think that the reason you did it is just because you felt you needed to stop yourself from attacking me, which, you know, I think is the way you saw it. Can you just, let's just think about that for a moment. Or you seem to think that I don't like you, and yet I'm not sure at all what makes you think that. What have I done that makes you think that? And, you know, I think that sometimes you distrust the people who are around you because you can't predict how they'll respond. And now, you know, you're here, you're really suspicious of me. And I think sometimes, you know, you are just critical of what I say so that you can dismiss what I say. And now all these are done in, you know, with a view to exploring alternative perspectives, exploring what's behind a particular state of mind. I think this very closely relates to Dr. Linehan's concept of validation. We can argue whether it's the same or not, and we, if it's the same, we do it for different reasons. We use transference, as Dr. Kernberg explained the concept, but it's for us, it's part of an interpersonal mind-mindedness. So it's a demonstration of alternative perspectives, a contrast between the patient's perception of the therapist or of others in the group and those of others. You know, so you see me as this awful person. I don't necessarily see myself like that. Let's see why you see me that way and why, you know, I might be actually someone quite different. We use a lot of irony, humor, self-deprecation. Now, I don't know whether that's a survival strategy or it's actually part of the same way of demonstrating how you can see things in different ways. So, you know, I think, well, look, I know that you think that I always think that I'm right, whatever happens. But look, just this once, just hear me out, okay? Just listen to what I have to say. Just try and ignore the fact that you know that I'm grandiose and it's probably true. So but we think that sometimes directly interpreting the transference to the patient, even if it's correct, may make the patient feel that what they experience is happening is unreal. If you say, look, you treat me in this way, and that's part of something that you do with other people or you do elsewhere, as if that wasn't something that was really just very real, if you know, I wasn't really a real cause of concern to that individual. That might put the individual what we called into pretend mode, where they nothing feels real. So let me now turn to the second major issue, third major issue, one of effectiveness. We have one study that's in the literature where we looked at a partial hospital treatment with a relatively small sample of patients with DIB scores of almost 8, quite a severe group of patients. There's random allocation and intent to treat analysis. And I should say at this stage is that what happened was not just psychotherapy in this treatment. We had three small groups. It's a partial hospital treatment. We had three small groups going on. We had two large groups going on, individual therapy as well, community meetings. So a lot was happening for the patients, but it all was happening from the single hymn sheet. It's always with that single aim in mind of enhancing mentalization. The control group had also, a lot of them had partial hospital treatment, but They were treated also in day centers. They went ricocheting around the UK system as treatment as usual groups tend to do. Although in the UK, they got far more input than an equivalent group would get in the US. These figures might be quite impressive from that point of view. This is the results. Suicide for us, contrary to Dr. Stanley's presentation, we define suicide as life-threatening, deliberate, had to be confirmed by medical intervention that was required and certified by an independent doctor. And what we found was that by 6 months, there was a very substantial drop of, that's 18 months of the treatment program, and that's 18 months follow-up. There was a very substantial drop to just over 30% of the start with almost 90% of the sample had a suicidal attempt. Self-mutilation took somewhat longer. This is, we defined it as any deliberate, deliberate attempt to cause visibly evident tissue damage, require nursing or medical intervention. And so by this criteria, about half of our patients were, more than half were still self-harming at 6 months, but this was then reduced to about a third of the sample by 18 months. And this, what we're heartened by is at the end of treatment, this reduced to a negligible during follow-up, a negligible number. We, in mentalization-based treatment, we focus very much on affect and continually name feelings, understand the immediate precipitance of feelings, the context of feelings in relationships, to express feelings appropriately, and so on. We find that there is a substantial improvement in anxiety scores, self-report anxiety scores. Similarly, self-report depression scores that continue to improve again after the end of treatment. This is the Hopkins symptoms checklist that had been talked about earlier today. Again, the improvements in this are significant but minor during the treatment, but really take off once the treatment ends. You might be interested in the cost. Again, this doesn't transfer easily to the US, during the year before treatment, the average cost of these patients was about $50,000 in both groups. This was reduced during the treatment period to about $27,000. And then at follow-up, in our group, it was $3,000, the cost of treatment, and $15,000 in the treatment as usual. Now, you notice this dramatic decline in the cost in the treatment as usual group, and you saw that this group did not improve on most of our measures very much. And the loss, the decreased cost is actually to do with the impatience of the National Health Service in offering intervention services for these individuals. It's not to do with their improvement. It's not the best reason. But the study has major limitations, the sample size, the control treatments were poorly specified. Had a multi-component treatment. We don't know which bit was effective. We don't have a replication site for the treatment yet, although there's one in Netherlands now. It's relatively costly compared to an outpatient treatment and requires a constant training of a staff team. In the process, with the help of the Borderline Research Foundation, we are in the process of doing another randomized controlled trial. I'm not going to talk about this at great length, but this time we're comparing mentalization-based treatment, individual outpatient basis, compared to a supportive psychotherapy that's non-manualized, again, random assignments. And what we are finding in terms of suicide attempts is that both the treatments appear to reduce suicide attempts at 6 months, but in mentalization-based outpatient therapy, that continues to improve for 18 months, and that's really where we are in the study at the moment, in about half our sample done. Similarly, the depression improves. Now, what I really want to talk about is this. Why on earth should any of this work? Or in fact, any therapy work. Now, what I'm going to present here are speculations that we are currently testing in number of studies, but I'd like you to test the speculation with you to the extent that does it fit with your experience of this disorder as either members of, as either an individual who suffers with the disorder, an individual who has a family member who suffers with the disorder, or a professional that works with the disorder. And our starting point is attachment. It's human attachment, which is perhaps the most important motivating force in the armamentarium of systems, behavioral systems, that any of us have. And the question that really I'm trying to answer is the question that was asked earlier today, that why is it that when you love, you can relieve suffering of people? Now, I'm going to start now with rodents, who have the answer to this. We now know from the work of Insel, who's the head of, no less a person than the head of NIMH, that quite a lot about the neural basis of an attachment system. So there is the reward system, as a mesocortical limbic dopaminergic system that we have known about for a long time, that's very important candidate in addiction, in mediating addiction, that's also critical in organizing the maternal behavior in rats, and pair bonding in voles. Voles have two subspecies. One of them form attachments, and you know they mate and they stick with that person, and another subspecies that actually doesn't. They just mate with anybody. And okay, 5 minutes should be fine. I thought I was getting marks out of five for a moment, but. Oh, okay, right. You know, they do that in ice skating, they do it. Maybe if I ice skated. No, sorry. Right. Anyway, pair bonding involves, you know, the same neural system is involved in it. So this circuit links the anterior hypothalamus to the ventral tegmental area, the nucleus incumbens, shell of it rather, and it may be particularly important in mediating the rewarding properties of social interaction. Now, it turns out that two neuropeptides are important in this, oxytocin and vasopressin, which are released by sociosexual experience in both rodents and humans. And this activates the reward circuits to change his attachment relationships, at least involves, you know, you feel good when you are attached. And then fMRI studies indicate the activation of the same pathways in relation to stimulating to your own infant and your partner. So we have kind of come quite close to identifying the neural systems underpinning attachment. There is one study that of many that I'm going to draw your attention to on maternal love. This is the parts of the brain that are activated when you look at a photograph of your own baby or a baby that's familiar to you but's not your own. And this attachment circuit is activated when you're looking at your own baby. It differentiates your own baby from other men. The anterior cingulate is involved, the orbitofrontal cortex is involved, ventral tegmental areas, and the bits of the brain that I've been talking about play important part in this. Now, also note that maternal love and romantic love activate the same part. It's attachment. You know, it's not. It's what's special about that person, whether it's your child or whether it's someone that you chose to spend the rest of your life with. So it's love. Why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this because activating this circuit is associated with deactivation of two other areas of the brain, and I'm not. You know, I can go through the particular areas involved, but the important thing to remember that when you this part of the brain is activated, other areas of the brain become deactivated. What are these areas? Well, one is the middle prefrontal, inferior parietal, and middle temporal cortex, mainly in the right hemisphere, as well as the posterior cingulate cortex. And what this part of the brain, this system is responsible for is attention, for long-term memory. It's involved variously in both positive, but it's mainly involved in negative emotion. And it probably underpins the interface of mood-related memory and cognition. So integrating memory, cognition with affect. The second bit of the brain, the temporal lobes, the parietotemporal junction, the mesial prefrontal cortex, is to do with social trustworthiness, judgments of social trustworthiness, moral judgments, theory of mind tasks, kind of solely negative emotions, and attention to one's own emotions. So this is the bit of the brain that you use to that underpins the determining other people's emotions and intentions. This is the bit of the brain that underpins mentalizing capacity, as I was talking about earlier. So what you have is that when the attachment system is activated, then two bits of the brain, the bit of the brain that's to do with the interface of mood and memory and cognition is deactivated, and another bit of the brain, the social trustworthiness, negative affect, and mentalizing is deactivated. Love is blind. You don't make social, oh dear, dear, dear. Suddenly my rating has gone right down. You don't make social judgments. Love is blind. Okay, let me just make the point that I wanted to say, that the deficit in mentalization that we observe in antisocial personality disorder and BPD perhaps, we observe in BPD only in the context of intimate relationship. So what I'm suggesting is the attachment system in borderline personality disorder is hypersensitive. It's triggered too readily. And we know that from the symptoms of borderline personality disorder, because the frantic efforts to avoid abandonment, because of patterns of unstable and intense interpersonal relationship, but that consequently, these other systems that I was talking to you about function, are deactivated and function inefficiently. The reason that individuals with BPD cannot mentalize is because their attachment system is too readily triggered by normal interpersonal relations where it normally would not be triggered, or is hyperactive in the context often of family relationships. And what we do in mentalization-based therapy is engage the patient in an attachment relationship with the therapist. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. But at the same time, paradoxically, encourage them to use the capacity which normally, because of the biological wiring of the brain, they would inhibit, so that they start to think regardless of the fact that they've activated their attachment system, and they start to think about their past and their present and integrating the past with their present, use their long-term memory at the same time as their capacity for social judgment. So I believe this is the reason why mentalization-based therapy works to the extent that it works, and this is the reason why other therapies work too. I shall grind to a halt here. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. We've got some questions for you. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. This first one is about how would you differentiate attachment deactivation of mentalization from transference and its successive focus or its focus on salient variables?
I think it's a question of the I don't think that you need transference in order to activate the attachment system. But I think that every instance of transference does imply the activation of the attachment system. Whether the transference is positive or negative, it is marked by the activation of that dopaminergic mesolimbic pathway that we were talking about. It's one is a subset of the other, if you think, see what I mean. So you don't have to have, you can have attachment without transference, as defined by Dr. Kernberg.
Do you see a correlation between ambivalent insecure attachment at 1 to 2 year olds, or in 1 to 2 year olds, and adult BPD? And is there a greater correlation between, I think this is avoidant insecure attachment, and adult BPD?
But this is a fascinating question. I think what our formulation is coming up with is that both types of insecure attachment, whether it be a dismissing attachment or entangled preoccupied attachment, there is an inefficient functioning of that inhibition between the attachment system and these other two cognitive systems that I was discussing. So, for example, in dismissing attachment, what you have is an overactive inhibition of long-term memory. So you cannot have access to important emotional experiences that determine your current attachment relationship. Whereas in preoccupied attachment, you have, if anything, you have too much access to those experiences. So it's both are inefficient, and so it's in a secure system, they're kept in balance. Now, I personally believe that whilst BPD is more often associated, statistically more often associated, with attachment systems when the attachment figures are too close to the self, which is in preoccupied attachment. But I don't think that that's uniquely so. I've come across individuals with borderline personality disorder who are extremely dismissing, mm-hmm. who deal with their incapacity to envision the mental states of attachment figures by having no attachment figures at all and living in total isolation. And that's a reaction, perhaps, but it is exemplified by the 37-year-old lady that Dr. Kernberg was discussing, who was completely living on her own, in total social isolation, because any time that she was with people, she felt confused by that experience, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Very good, okay. This is a more practical question. How much treatment did the patients receive in follow-up?
That's a very good question. Now, I don't know of a randomized controlled trial of BPD, or in fact any other randomized controlled trial of any psychological disorder, where during the follow-up, patients didn't receive additional treatment. In our case, we organized that so they had the opportunity to attend a group in the partial hospital if they wanted to. So they were discharged from the partial hospital, but they could, if they wanted to, come back for a group, which met once weekly.
Right. How is mentalization similar to or different from mindfulness? I believe they're probably talking mindfulness in the DBT model.
Yeah. I mean, I like not to walk where others fear to tread. I've made a promise to myself never to talk about other people's treatments. I've not been trained in DBT. If I made a comment about mindfulness, it would be probably incorrect. But as I read it, it's much more related to what DBT therapists talk of as validation. Identifying what the thoughts and feelings of the person might have been. It's less it's less focused on it underscores it makes it's I think it's as important for DBT therapists as for us, but it's perhaps less a unique focus for them as it is for us.
Okay. Let's see. We have another one here. This one, whether you maybe comment on this one. How does your explanation of the neurobiology of mentalization deal with the latest self-referential emotion research?
With mirror neuron stuff, or
yeah.
I promised myself that I'd understand the mirror neuron research one day. That day has not yet come. And, you know, I just make such a fool of myself if I started talking about it, that why don't I just be honest and say, I don't know. Maybe refreshing.
Exactly. Another practical one. Why is there no physical activity group in your day hospital schedule?
Well, we have psychodrama, which can be very physical.
Yeah.
But it's not specifically exercise.
Right.
If we had a good theory why exercise actually enhanced mentalization, we would include exercise. There must be a reason. There must be a way in which exercise enhances mentalization, because whenever I've done some exercise, my head clears and I'm able to think. But unfortunately, it doesn't happen often enough for me to know the answer to that question.
Okay. Right. I'm going to interrupt our questions for 1 second. Somebody seems to have lost their keys, which is a loss of attachment of sorts, but there you are. Look like lots of house keys and a car key, and we have them here.
And you will be humiliated by having to walk up to the...
Well, I think I'll pass them to my colleague in the front row. Mm-hmm. But they're here if you need them, which I'm sure you will. Thanks. Okay, another one. Let's see. Do you believe that the relationship between the therapist and the client or the patient is at the core of any successful therapy?
Absolutely, and this is, and I hope that I was clear about the reasons why. Unless you establish an attachment relationship with your client, I do not think that you have any hope of causing anything like stable therapeutic change. And I think that actually clinical and research evidence speaks to that, that therapeutic alliance is the only good predictor of outcome, of all the predictors of outcome. In psychotherapy, and I think therapeutic alliance is a variable that reflects the establishment of an attachment relationship. So I do think that you have to be real with your patients, and you have to become a real attachment figure at the same time as doing what attachment figures do not normally do, that is focusing them on thinking about mental states. I mean, there's a reason people say love is blind. The reason that love is blind is because when you're in love with somebody, you don't think about what makes them tick. You just think, gosh, I'm in luck. This wonderful person loves me. And that's it. And you switch all those other kind of social, you know, judgmental bits of your brain off, which leads us to all kinds of difficulties from time to time. But,
This one may be related. It seems more like this is something to comment on. The problem is not with the kind of therapy, but the therapist's ability or especially inability to contain affects and recycle negative affects back into the patient. The therapist's own inability to tolerate one's own affects and or to tolerate the patient's accusatory, manipulative affects and not retaliate in tone, more importantly than words.
I think that's absolutely, that's a very sensitive and accurate comment. that you will notice that that is, when you do that, then you're no longer mentalizing for the patient. You've stopped thinking of them as someone who has depth, or has thought you've turned them into a cardboard cutout of, you know, somebody who's trying to manipulate, and you're no longer really interested in what is going on in their mind. A good therapist can put themselves over that hump and see the person who has to do that in that situation for some reason. And what you need to get at, what you need to matter, is what the reason is that they need to do that at that particular time. Not quite selfishly seeing it yourself, what impact this is having on me, and from that, you generate a model of their mind. Well, you're making me feel damn silly and stupid and unhappy, and that's what you must have wanted to do. Which is the kind of state of mind that we can get into, which I think is non-mentalizing. You no longer see the person at that point.
Right. And one last one. If I'm understanding you correctly, would it be helpful for the patient to have access to the therapist during crises based on interpersonal issues to help activate both systems in the brain?
I think we do give access. I mean, so for example, our rule is in our manual that if the patient consults you by email, you reply by email. They consult you by phone, you reply by phone. So you do engage and interact, but always with the same kind of focus in mind. So say that the patient contacts in order to disclose and a wish to harm themselves or take their own life or whatever. You, at that stage, you do a threat assessment that we have, again, we have manualized, but then you, once you've reduced your own anxiety, which is your first step, you then have to engage with trying to identify, using whatever the media is, what are the emotional states that the patient was not able to mentalize that led to their wish to do this, that, or the other. So you don't engage with the threat so much as the state of mind that was antecedent to the threat.
Okay, with that, we have to stop. Thank you very, very much.